interview with Harold Martin, editor and publisher, Montgomery Advertiser, Montgomery, Alabama, July 15th, 1974.
One thing I'd like for you to tell us just a little bit about your own experiences with George Wallace and the paper's experiences, and how you perceive him and what's been his effect on Alabama politics.
Well, I came to Montgomery when Carmody Wallace bought his paper in 1963, just about the same time that George Wallace came as governor.
He came from
Birmingham. He came in January, and I came here in March of the same year. And the relations with the paper have been all right in ways, and it just depends on what. This is a very aggressive paper, and I don't think that George Wallace had been treated any differently than any other governor. It just happened that he's the only governor with a small short time that Brewer was governor, and we printed lots about Brewer too while he was governor, and we just considered our job to watch the government and what they were doing, and so we've had lots of controversy with him over things like this. At one time, I don't really remember what the issue was. We would print editorials, and he would call up. And he used to call me all the time. He didn't do this anymore. He would call and raise Cain about the editorial. One time we managed somebody to come up there and talk to him. And I went up and talked to him. At this point, we printed every year a special section on the, they started off at the, after the governor had been in it for a year. They'd done this on other governors too. And this was about the second year, I guess, that he'd been in. It could have even been the third. And they were laying a section out, and Wallace called me about some editorial. All I recall is it had something to do with the Confederate flag being on the dome of the Capitol. And he was pretty livid in which he said that we accused him of being a traitor. And somewhere in the conversation, he got around to the special section that we were using, that we were going to produce, and said that we had were using him to sell the section with. And I told him this wasn't true. And he said, well, one of my people got a letter that you'd sent out saying that I approved of it. And I said, well, if you get that gentleman up here, we'll tell him he's a liar because we haven't sent any letters out. All we've done so far is just plan the section. And besides that, if you object to the section going out as having anything to do politically, we'll just drop it because it didn't mean that much. What it was bringing the state up with accomplishments of what it had been happening. Couldn't do anything but help him because it was an industrial-type section. And sold to the cities and the counties and to anybody that would buy it. And the thing wound up, he had several of his people in, and he wound up by asking me what the editorial meant. I told him it meant just what it said, that he put the flag up there and that it would take someone else to take it down because he'd already said he wasn't going to. And so he insisted that he kept talking about editorial, and then he switched back to advertising. I said, well, now you switch, keep to one at a time and let's solve them. Are you objecting to advertising or are you objecting to the editorials? Now, I don't want to talk to both of you about the two together. So he said, well, I'm objecting to the editorials. And I said, all right, then we'll discuss the editorial. And we went over it, and I didn't write it. And I think Bill McDonald did. Again, he asked me what it meant, and I said, just what it said. It's silly. And that the flag was put up there in the observance of the centennial, and that you made statements that it's going to stay there, and that some other government will have to take it down if it ever comes down. This, as you remember, at the time was a controversy. And the whole thing was kind of manufactured, from our viewpoint anyway. Every time we journalists from out of state, and especially television people would come in, they would take the camera and they would point it up there, and they'd say, see, they don't even fly the flag on the Capitol. Well, the flagpole is around at the side, which you can't see going up the Dexter Avenue. And the American flag did fly on the flag, on the pole where it's always flown, ever since the Capitol was built, I assume. And the other always had just the state flag on. Well, in checking other states, we find that lots of states do the same thing. They fly their state flag on the Capitol and then have a flagpole for the American flag. And to say this, this flag was just put up during the centennial. And
this is the old Confederate battle flag.
Yes. Well, it was a Confederate flag.
And but this, Wallace had not put the flag up?
Yes.
He had put it up as part of
for a centennial celebration. And he had left it there. And what we were really saying in the editorial is it's a lot to do over nothing. I mean, it's causing lots of dissension and lots of talk over it when it really doesn't make any difference. The American flag is flying around here. But he read into this that it was saying that he was a traitor because he wouldn't take the flag down. He was a traitor to the country or something. Didn't say that. But it did say he wouldn't take it down. I mean, just a flat statement. He said, we better we'll face it. It's going to stay there. Which he had said in a statement. Well, I came on back to the office, and he said, well, will you tell me whether or not, just what that means? And I said, yes, I'll tell you what it means. I mean, just what it said. He said, well, will you go back and ask Bill McDonald if that's what he meant? And I said, I'd be glad to, but I can tell you what he's going to say before I go back. And he kept talking about this special section we were going to run. And I kept asking him if he were trying to threaten me that he were going to stop the special section, which I guess he could put the word out. He didn't want anybody to advertise any, but it didn't really make that much difference to us. I mean, it was just an industrial section that the advertising department had gotten up. It had nothing to do with news. And so I came on back and talked to Bill McDonald. He told me to call Ed Ewing back and tell him. So I called Bill, talked to Bill McDonald, called Ed Ewing back, and I said, Ed, Bill said that the editorial means exactly what it said. It's pretty plain English, and there's no use in getting any further explanation of it. And I said, and you tell the governor that it's my opinion that he was trying to threaten us with advertising. And so I'm just going to cancel the advertising section, because I don't want anything tied in politically with our advertising. And he said, oh, I assure you the governor didn't mean that. He didn't mean that at all. And I said, well, I think he did. And as a result, I'm going to cancel this section. I'm going to print it. And I did. So about 2 months later, I was making a speech one night, and still down here working about 7 o'clock when the phone rang, and it was Wallace. And he said, Harold, said, I've just been sitting up here thinking about our conversation. And said, I didn't want to apologize to you. He said, I really know better than that. And said, now some people are going to say the governor backed down. And I said, well, Governor, I don't see what it's backing down about. We were discussing the editorial, and as far as I'm concerned, significant in the editorial. And I don't really know what you're talking about in backing down, but I do appreciate you calling me. And nothing was said about it in the special section. So 2 days after this, well, we always had a rundown of all the state departments and all in this section, too. So about 2 days after this, advertising director got a call from Ed Ewing. He said, now we'll make all the statistics and everything for the state available to you for this special section you're going to run. And so he said, well, didn't Mr. Martin tell you we're going to cancel that section? And he said, no, they got that all straightened out. He said, no, Mr. Martin told me to cancel the section. We're not even working on it anymore. And we did, and that was the end of that. And it was one of these situations where they just the advertising department didn't run it, and it didn't make a lot of difference to us. But this was the first run-in, which indicated to me that he was trying to tell me what to put in the paper. He wanted to in fact, he had asked me on the one before when Bill Jones was up there if he could read. Bill Jones called me and asked me if he could read this section, what was in it, and I told him no. He called me 3 or 4 times during the day, and he called me back late that night and said the governor told me he couldn't go to bed and find out what was in that section. Would I let him read it? And I told him no. He could read in the papers like everybody else. Birmingham News printed one. They took it up and let him read it and go through the whole thing. It's just an industrial section. Again, it's something silly, but from a news viewpoint, we didn't feel like anybody ought to be seeing what we don't ever read anyone read a story before we print it. And we go. regards to who it is or what the conditions are, unless it's a lawyer, our lawyer. Well, a little while after this, and we ran editorials, and for a while he'd call me up on the editorial, and I set broad editorial policy here, but I don't pre-read the editorials. I do this on purpose. I think we have two of the best editorial products in the country, and I think this is the reason we have them. The advertiser doesn't always agree with the journal, and sometimes I don't agree with either one of them. But they're creative, and they do an excellent job, and I want to keep it that way. And so that's the way they run. So when an editorial comes out, I read it in the paper like everyone else. And the governor would call me up about an editorial. He'd call me at home, and I'd always say, well, I hadn't read it yet. And so tell me what it said. And he'd go over and I'd kind of laugh about it and pass it off. And he did this for 6-7 months, and he just quit. And then one day, this is when Grover Hall came up to my office. Bob Ingram was political writer then, and said that Bob had just left the governor's office, and that the governor said he was going to cut off our whiskey advertising because we had said bad things about him in the editorials. And unless we would agree not to do this anymore, he was going to cut off the whiskey advertising. Well, there's no way legally that the governor can cut off any whiskey advertising because governor, the state doesn't place any whiskey advertising. What it is, the state has ABC boards, and an ABC board, and they sell the whiskey in the state stores. And this had been done once before. As I get into it, you'll see how it is done. Legally, they place no advertising, therefore there would be no way for them to cut any advertising off. And I asked Grover, I said, well, what is it you want me to do? And he said, well, I've talked to him, and I think he's going to do it. And I said, well, unless what? And he said, unless you give him assurances that you're not going to write an editorial about him. And I said, well, you know better than that. And so about 2 days later, Bob Ingram came in and said that he was in the governor's office, and the governor picked up the telephone and called Mr. Caldwell, the ABC administrator, in his presence, and told him to cut off the advertising, whiskey advertising, for the advertiser, Mungum advertiser. What he specifically told him was to tell the distributor that if they advertised in these papers, then he would put their whiskey under the shelf where it couldn't be sold. So it's not really the state cutting it off, but it's an illegal means of getting to the people distributors. Well, we called several distributors, and we never could get any, and the cancellations came in. Everything was canceled. And we never could get any of the distributors to admit why they canceled. They just said, well, we're going to pull our products out of there for a while, or we're going to test somewhere else or something like this. Well, no one would ever give us a direct statement. Well, we stayed off a while, and I guess he released it. All of a sudden, we started getting it again. And this happened about 3 times. And it was always after we'd run an editorial, and we'd lose every time it'd be canceled for a month or two, and then 7 months later, it'd come back. And then during the campaign, when Lurleen was running, we got the cancellations again. And this time, it was permanent. We stayed off about 13 months. It cost us roughly $100,000. But we were determined that we never asked him to put it back. We did run a story of what he had done on the front page. But as far as going beyond that, we didn't do anything. We did research, and we found in our letters one telegram from a distributor saying that he had been contacted by the governor, by the ABC board, and told not to advertise in the paper. We thought this sufficient to file a suit for interference with trade, and prepared to do so. And just as we got ready to file a suit, Lurleen went in the hospital, and we decided that this just wasn't the time to file any suit against the governor and her in the hospital. So we never did file it. And after she died, I ran into Brewer. Immediately after I didn't actually contact him myself. After he was elected, I sent someone up, the advertising director, to tell him that we didn't think that he would get involved in this, but we had a suit ready to file, and we had been holding it back because Lurleen being in the hospital. And we were going to file it if it happened again. And he said, well, I wouldn't do anything like that, anything illegal like that. So that was the end of that. We were off. that time, I guess, about 13 months. That's about the only problems, as far as problems we've ever had.
Now, how about after you came back in 1970? That
Never received any cancellations or anything. It's never been discussed.
How about editorial policies? Have you discussed that since then?
No, he didn't talk to me anymore. He called me just before the election one night, just before this past election, and talked about two hours, and asked me to endorse him. And I just told him I didn't see how I could do that. And that's the only conversation I've had with him during this time, unless I, you know, just run into him in a meeting or something.
Why do you think that you ought to endorse him?
Why
did he think that you ought to endorse him?
Well, he wants everybody to endorse him.
But you never had before.
The paper had endorsed him, I believe, before I came down here, 63, when Grover Hall, and when he was running in 62. The paper had endorsed him then, but I don't think that really had anything to do with it. I asked him if he thought there was any race to it at all, and he said, oh no, I'm going to beat him in his own county. Excuse me, let me take this call.
George Wallace's overall impact on the state? I mean, has he been good or bad for Alabama?
Well, that's a pretty broad question. Let me answer it this way. My complaint, if it's a complaint, or our criticism of Wallace has been the entire time that he's been interested in everything except Alabama, that he's never been interested in being governor of Alabama, and that he's won a poor administrator, partially because he doesn't like administration, partially because he didn't have time to fool with it. And I don't think he's made any impact on Alabama to any great degree other than just being there. I don't think any programs, if you want to look at the programs that he put in, he would go back to the junior colleges and the college program and the vocational schools and the free textbooks as being his doing. Well, we had free textbooks up through grammar school when I was in grammar school, and they'd just been stopped. And there's a good little story in that, too. I was on a committee. It's not the committee that's been appointed now. This was a kind of unofficial committee. Most of them were educators from the different colleges. And about the time this junior college program came up, well, we met with the hotel, and Governor Wallace came down to explain the Free Textbook Act and the junior college program to him. And when he finished, we asked him one question. Well, two questions, one on each one. We said, Governor, let's talk about the free textbooks. Wouldn't it be better to be sure we had the money to give the free textbooks all the way through and start with a certain number of grades the first year and be sure everyone had textbooks and then add a grade every year? These were educators. I don't know why I was on the committee, but I was. And his answer to that was, if you dare to as much as make a statement against the free textbooks, I will guarantee you there'll never be another race of teachers as long as I'm the governor of the state of Alabama. And believe me, there are more truck drivers and taxi drivers and common people that want free textbooks than there are teachers. So that disposed of that question. The next question on the junior colleges was, aren't we in some kind of danger in building 16 or 17 junior colleges and vocational schools at one time? Wouldn't we be better to plan these over a period of years for about three reasons? One, to be sure that they're placed where they're needed and not placed politically. And two, to be sure that they can be properly staffed without robbing all of the high school principals or top people to staff these junior colleges and leaving a vacancy there which can't be overcome that quick. And three, to be sure we got the money to build them with without having to worry about the money at the end of the year. The answer to that took about 40 minutes, and it was a discourse on his trips around the country, how he made food out of people at Harvard and how he was smarter than they are, and that he told them, said, if you tell some other boy, ask him a question, he said, you tell me if you're a he or a she, I'll answer that question. Said, just went on and on about his campaigns, and in the middle of this, he threw a sentence in that scared everybody, which he said we ought to write all of our textbooks in Alabama anyway. We've got enough people here that are smart enough, and we should never use a textbook written outside the state. And wound up with the discourse of how many junior colleges they have in California, and if we're as smart as they are, so we ought to have as many colleges as they do. And that was the end of the explanation of the junior colleges. I think the program was a good program. No one ever questioned whether or not we should have junior colleges. No one ever questioned whether or not we should have free textbooks. It was just the method that was to be used. Now, as an example, we have a junior college in Alexander City, which is 50 miles from here. We run three buses a day taking people from Montgomery to the junior college, although we have two colleges here run by the state. So this was the type of thing we were talking about. And so the junior college program, the free textbooks, is a wonderful program. But whether or not George Wallace added anything to it by the way it was handled, because it was completely politically handled the way after it got started. So sure, certainly the program was a good program, and he was governor while it was done. It was good. He gives figures all the time of how much industry he's brought in. He has brought in, the government has brought in, the state government has brought in, and how much we've advanced, and yet we've advanced not near as much as the other southeastern states around us. The per capita income in the state of Alabama has had a pretty substantial increase, and yet only Mississippi and Arkansas that's the only two states that's lower than us in per capita income in the whole United States. So it just has to look at what you're comparing it with. If we're comparing it with have we made progress in Alabama? Yes, I think we have. Have we kept up with the progress of the other southeastern states? No, we haven't. So who can say whether or not we would have made the progress that we made without Wallace, or with someone else, or would we have made more with someone else? I don't know. We have made progress, yes.
Let me ask you a question about that free textbook, because I want to understand it, because I think it's sort of significant in understanding Wallace. So the state had free textbooks, and then it was discontinued.
And I don't know when it was discontinued. All I know is that when I was going to school, to grammar school, at elementary school, I went to school in Birmingham.
This would have been when?
Good night. 1930, I started, I guess. Let's
see. So in the 30s, they had free textbooks.
Well, at the time I graduated from grade school, grammar school, 8 years. We had no junior colleges, no junior high schools in the Birmingham system. We have 8 years and then 4 years in the high school. But I received free textbooks all the way through the eighth grade, and then you bought your own in high school.
You don't know whether that was strictly a local situation?
No, I don't. But in Jefferson County.
But when he started the free textbooks, he started all 12 grades, is that it?
Yes. They started all at the same time. What we wanted to do was maybe take six. And the first year that the program was in, there was not enough textbooks to go around. And they didn't get enough allotment for them, and some of the kids were having to use someone else's books and pass the books around. Just exactly what we were afraid was going to happen. Did happen. Just exactly what we had pointed out to him could happen in the junior colleges did happen. Not only did they build them in some wrong places, some of them in places where they shouldn't have been because of politics. The staffing was a tremendous problem. They did take the top people out of the other systems, which did hurt. And staffing that many junior colleges at one time when we already did it, were short of teachers, didn't help the situation. It didn't have the quality of the education. It took several years to get the junior colleges up to what they ought to be. Now, maybe that's inevitable with a new school. I'm not an educator. I don't know.
To go back to the assessment of Wallace, some people assert that here was a man who occupied an office that institutionally was one of the strongest in the country. I mean, the governor's office in this state is very strong. The legislature, in comparison to that office, is quite weak. Has been. He's been able to dominate that legislature. In other southern states, there have been real reform movements to write new constitutions, to reorganize the executive branch, tax reform, and so on. Yet you see none of that with Wallace, and he's been dominating the state politics for the last, since 1963.
Well, he's been dominating the state politics. Now, Alabama has, if you analyze the state government under the analysis that a political scientist would use, we have a weak governor form, not a strong governor. You know, they analyze this as strong and weak according to how many committee heads he appoints and how many are elected. We do not come under it. The reason the governor has been dominant, the governor has always been the titular head of the Democratic Party in Alabama, and there's been no other party. He has dominated always simply by his willpower and by his access to the people. You know, and Governor Folsom ran into this in his term in office. He was elected by a majority, and the legislature just rebelled against everything he did. And he got nothing through, absolutely nothing. Wallace, on the other hand, the legislature, he was so popular with the people, the legislature would not buck him. He threatened to have everybody defeated that did buck him, and on one occasion in the election did so. Everybody that had opposed his program was defeated. So his power came from the people. No question about it. To me, it's a tragedy. Here's a man that had the people would do anything that he asked them to do, and he didn't ask them to do it.
That was my question. Why? Why is this?
Because he's completely motivated by politics. He has no interest in the state of Alabama, never has had. He's a poor administrator, didn't know anything about administration, and he just hadn't proposed anything. He's been too busy running for something else rather than trying to run the state.
Yeah, but meanwhile, he talks, you know, like a populist. That's like an economic liberal. What you need is a progressive tax reform and all that sort of stuff. But you really have none of it back here that I can see.
13, 19, now in town.
Because the only legislation during the last session of the legislature, which they had a very poor performance themselves, but the only thing that the governor puts forward was he told him he didn't want any taxes and he wanted the budget passed. And he got the budget passed and he got no taxes. That's a total effort put out by the governor's office to lead the legislature.
No, like last week when he was talking to the Democratic chairman in Washington, to the association up there, he's talking about the need for tax reform at the national level. We've got to make it more progressive. It's too regressive. And if you look at this state's tax system, you couldn't say it's progressive. Well, what I'm saying is, you know, there seems to be a lot of rhetoric, but when it translates down into performance, there doesn't seem to be much performance.
There's not. There's been no leadership. State of Alabama hasn't had any leadership. That's what I'm saying is Wallace has been running for some office all the time rather than leading, offering any leadership to the state of Alabama. He is he's offered no leadership to the state.
Is that one of the keys to his personality? That just an intense interest only in campaigning and then.
I don't know whether that's a key to it or not. He has a tremendous personality, and he's sharp and he's quick with his answers. And he has a rapport with people because he's convinced people that he's for them, although if you analyze what he says, it's not there. But the people have gone along with it. I think it is key to his personality is that he just has an outgoing personality. And he's good at names. He remembers people's names, and he calls their names, and he just gets close to people. But he's offered no leadership for the state. The beginning years were nothing but, you want to talk about your rhetoric, was nothing but talk too. The integration was the schools is a good example of that. Although Wallace made all the talk at the University of Alabama about what he was going to do and what he was trying to do, this was completely political. The students were already admitted. They had already pre-registered. They had their classes set up. They had their dormitory space. They had been promised by the Board of Trustees that they would be entered if they waited the list time. And then the Board of Trustees, after talking with Wallace, decided it would be better for a federal court to tell them to do it. The day they went down and stood in the schoolhouse door, everything was already settled before they got down there. But yet, if you ask people, and the schools have been in the and if you ask people about this, they'd say, well, George really tried. He's against integrating schools. And we say, well, look, the schools were integrated. And they would always come back and say, yes, but he tried. We ran some polls, and people, the trait that they admired most about Wallace was the fact that he fought for what he believed. on these poles, and this was done professionally. We didn't do it ourselves. And on these, people would put, even his enemies would put, he's a racist or he's a dictator. And then over on the back part where it says, what do you admire about him, they would put in there, we admire the way he fights for what he thinks is right. This is, of course, what defeated Albert Brooks, because he wouldn't fight. And this had always been true in Alabama. Alabama has always had a governor that would speak out and would take up for what he thought was right. And Wallace has done that. Whether he thought it was right or not, I don't know. People always say, well, has the governor changed? Sure, the governor's changed, because times have changed, and what politician wouldn't change? Did they always get back to him and say, well, has he mellowed because of being wounded? Well, I don't know that either. Nobody knows that except him. But the change was already evident before this. He was making the change because the situation's changed. A man can't get elected on the race question, I don't think. We didn't think he could the last time, but he did. But he can't get elected nationally on the type of views that he was putting out before. So he changed his views. Now, whether this is a real change and what motivated it, I don't know, but we expected it here. Anyway, his conditions changed. He adapted himself to the condition because he's 100% political.
What was the reaction to your speech calling for Wallace to step down?
The reaction from whom now? From the people?
What were the reactions then to that?
All right, the reaction at the Capitol wasn't very good, but let's go back to what really precipitated that thing. After Wallace was, I'm smart enough to know that this wasn't going to cause him to resign. Wasn't the call for this. He was in bad health. The state wasn't doing anything. And no one dared criticize him.
This was when? Late 72, early 73?
Well, I'll have to look it up. It was while he was still in the hospital. Now, he was back at the mansion at this time. But since he had been wounded, no one had issued any complaint, any criticism of Wallace at all. And it looked like it was time that somebody started bringing the state back to face reality. And it had to start by saying that nobody's running the state. And you had to blame it on the governor, or the governor's the circumstances surrounding the governor, whatever, being wounded and not running the state, and a bunch of his henchmen running it for him. And so this accomplished what I expected it to accomplish. It started criticism, pro and con, the criticism and the criticism of the criticism, I guess, about Wallace's condition. Wallace told somebody sometime that the best thing that ever happened to him made him mad enough to fight harder and get well. If it did, that's wonderful. The facts were true. The facts that I gave him in there, that the state was being run by a bunch of parasites, and he wasn't controlling it. And at the time, I was sincere, and that is what should have been done, although I never expected that to happen. I got no adverse criticism, if that's what you're talking about, from people. If you're talking about hate letters or anything like that, no. Got about, and this was really shocked me. We got more letters complimentary than we did the letters of criticism. But when I say we, I mean the paper. They gave me the paper. We ran a few of them, representative of both sides. But I actually received more letters of complimentary of what was said than criticizing was saying. But as far as any real adverse reaction, didn't get any. But it did open communications up again. It opened senators and other legislators who decided now they could talk. One of them wrote a letter saying this was true, saying that they couldn't get in to talk to the governor. Every time they got to talk to him, they'd talk to somebody else. That answer that?
What do you think is going to happen after Wallace leaves the state political scene? Well, to run for the Senate or whatever? Or in whenever? And where do you see the state heading politically after Wallace?
I don't know. It's just depending on It was a long time to election. Depends on who's elected, I guess. This is a good state. It's my home. I'm not critical of the state. I think we could have made a lot more progress than we've made, but I do think we have made some progress. And under the circumstances, we've done pretty good. I think the climate in the state is acceptable to leadership. I think they want leadership. And if we get that type of leadership in the next administration, I think people will be receptive to it. But right now, I don't know. I don't know who's going to. I don't think you can look now and say, well, Beasley or Baxley, the only two you can see now, they're going to be the next governor. That may be true, that may not. Just depending on what happens. 3 years.
Well, if he's totally political, wouldn't he try to extend his influence beyond 1978, either by running Cornelia or in some way trying to stay active?
I don't think so. George has never been successful in trying to translate his popularity to someone else. For example, during his last time when he won, he backed a candidate up north, Alabama Williams. He lost the Senate for Senator. Lost very handily. And lost mainly because Wallace interfered in it. He sent a state, and because we printed the interference, he sent one of the state workers up in a state truck, a car full of documents or campaign literature. The fellow had a wreck, just drove it all over the highway, and this kind of let it out. People just got mad he was interfering. He had a relative, his Reeves, that he was backing for the legislature in South Alabama, and he lost. I don't think he could pull off another one. Lurleen would have pulled this off one time. It's very unlikely to be done twice. Of course, again, you don't know, but I wouldn't doubt it. I don't know if this ever happened in Alabama that a man could extend his authority after he were out. Well, not his authority as much as it's hard to transfer your popularity.
Is Wallace's popularity now based as much on sympathy as anything else?
The polls, which I can show you that we had run, and this has been a year or so ago now, was completely sympathy. You'd have to interpret it in which the people would say this was done not too long after the speech asking him to retire, in which the majority of the people did not want him to run for president again. But we ran polls before he ran the last time, and the majority of the people didn't want him to run then. But when it got to the governor's question as to whether or not he should run, the answers were no, that he should not run again. But then when it got down to who would you vote for, it was George Wallace, and heavily weighted in that direction. So the interpreter of the polls interpret this as being similar.
And if he were to decide to run for the Senate in 78, particularly Sparkman did not run, presumably would be the man to beat, the general perception.
I would assume so, because I don't know anybody else right now politically. See, we just don't have anybody. This has been another thing. Wallace has been so dominant that he's kept other people from rising up because people just have not wanted to run against him, and you have had no outstanding statewide leadership because of that. So I don't really see anybody else on the scene right now. If you notice the last election, the whole election's wrapped around who's closest to Governor Wallace.
So one
Beasley used this, Woods used it, even Don Collins, the Republican, beginning to use it.
So one effect then has been that he has, in effect, frozen political development in the state.
I think that's true.
In both parties?
There's no Republican Party here. The Republican Party. And I don't want to, well, they wouldn't like that statement, I guess, there's no Republican Party, but in the Goldwater, when Goldwater was elected, we elected the county commission Republican. One of the commissioners had run four or five times before, and he was more shocked than anybody in the city when he was elected, or anybody in the county. He's since been defeated. What have we got in the legislature now in the way of Republicans? Bill Dickinson and Congress was elected at the same time, and once a person gets in, he's on the military committee, it'd be very hard to defeat him. It'd also be very hard for another Republican elected to that office. John Buchanan in Birmingham and Jack Edwards in Mobile are popular individuals, and once they get in, it's at the time. And they all went in at the same time. It'd be hard to defeat them with a Democrat or another Republican. Another Republican couldn't defeat them either. They're not running anyone to mount anything for governor. They don't have any enough people running in the office for offices to say they even have a Republican Party. They'll field two or three candidates, but then they'll stay away from the big ones. And until they get to the point they can do that, I'd say there's no effective Republican Party.
What are the basic political changes that you've seen in the last 25 years in this state?
Well, if you're talking about 25 years, you're going back to Governor Folsom, coming up from that time. See, 25 years doesn't encompass lots of other people since Wallace has been in so long now. But Folsom was talking about it, a constitutional revision when he was elected in 46. Bush fought and tried to get it. Folsom was talking about the one man, one vote in 1946. Folsom was way ahead of his time in the thing that he was advocating. But I haven't seen any basic political change. Still trying to get the constitutional reform through. We've had, during the last few years, a good bit of judicial reform because of fine chief justices were elected. Been more change in there than that's the only department that has really changed. But there's nothing else that's changed practically. State's still running outside the federal changes.
And some of the people we talk to assert that the basic political and social change that have occurred in this state have come about because of the federal judiciary.
Right, that's what I said. There's been nothing except federal changes. Yeah. And this is true all the way through. We printed stories about the prisons. Just story after story about the thing. It's a series, and at the end of this, we wound up with one warden getting a year sentence, prison sentence, got a parole on. Two wardens being fired, and the prison commissioner fired. As soon as Wallace went in, he brought back the commissioner that was fired as the assistant. And we wrote some more stories, and they fired him again. But no changes were made in prison reform until the two prisoners, with all of this, all the investigation, all the proof that it was there, but nothing was done until two or three prisoners filed a federal suit, and the federal court took it over and told them what to do. Lurleen did a lot, and it's not critical of her. She had an intense interest in mental health, and I think had she lived, she would have made some reform. But with all the talking that he picked up, that George picked up about what he was going to do in mental health, nothing was done in mental health until the Stigney case was filed. And the federal court told them what they had to do in mental health. And you can go right down the line with this. Education and everything else has been done by federal court. The reapportionment. The legislature didn't want to do it because it was unpopular. So they let the federal court do it for them and then fuss about the way they reapportioned.
Property tax
the same way. Now that's something you should have, according to Wallace, should have been done a long time ago. And it should have been done a long time ago.
Could he have done it a long time ago if he'd wanted to do it?
I really believe that Wallace was popular enough that he could have done anything he wanted to. By doing it, do you mean could he have gotten it past the legislature?
Right.
I think he could have had anything passed he wanted in the legislature. I think he'd have done anything he wanted done. At one time, not the last legislature, but the one before that, I think they would have done anything he wanted done. But no one wanted to do this because it wasn't popular with the people, and it wasn't popular with certain interest groups like the Farm Bureau.
How influential is the Farm Bureau?
Oh, I think they're very influential. They put lots of money into campaigns, and it's a real active organization, always has been. If I can read B.O. Key's assessment of it, the same today it was when Key wrote.
How about the other interest groups?
Oh, there's so many of them. It's everybody's got an interest group. This is what the ethics bill. This is an example now of how we do, how things have been conducted. The ethics bill started off as in an effort to control interest groups and their relationship with the legislature. Now, again, if you go back and look at some of the things we've printed during the past year, few years, you find engineering contracts, money being handed to people for doing no work on federal highways, and then the federal government, when it got right down to it, didn't have enough guts to do anything about it except stop it. But they didn't have any enough nerve to fight Wallace and to get him involved with any of his people. Had his brother selling asphalt, his brother bought an asphalt company selling asphalt to the state. I think we were able to prove that it was costing about 50 cents a ton extra for all of the asphalt that the state bought because of the way the bids were being put out. And they were giving fake bids to each other. By fake, I mean they'd get three of them would go together and submit bids, and then they'd just divided the state up with this. We spent money in engineering contracts that were with no engineering done. They spent the money on the asphalt more than we needed on it. And all the way through all this as was happening, these are special interest groups. So we printed so much of this that the people just got upset. Because now if an average businessman that was elected to the legislature and he did anything, if he took any of this, he's liable for prosecution. But if an attorney did it, he just listed it as a retainer, and it was perfectly legal for him to do anything he wanted to. The optricians had a legislator. The truckers had a legislator. Almost any group that your insurance people had a legislator, and all of them had one or more. The power company, all of them had legislators on the payroll as retainers, listed as retainers. And so the ethics bill came about as in an effort to make legislators disclose who they were taking money from. And, people that had anything in the Senate or in the House or Senate.